At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, August 27th, 2025. And on today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll talk a bit about the new movie Honey Don't. We'll present an interview with a cast member of Marvel's Thunderbolts and wrap things up with a listener email. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And once again, it's just me for this first segment here talking about some news stuff. We find ourselves in the dog days of summer right now. There's a lot of people out on vacation, things like that. There aren't really a ton of like huge AAA studio movies to talk about, but we still have a lot to get to in this episode. So let's kick things off by jumping into the news here. First up, this was reported a few days ago, Nicolas Cage is in talks to star in True Detective Season 5. So we know that the fifth season is going to be set in the Jamaica Bay area of New York City, and Issa Lopez, who is the showrunner of True Detective Night Country, is going to be coming back. So that's exciting news, and man, Nick Cage in a True Detective story, that is kind of wild. Obviously, the latest big name actor to appear in this franchise, assuming this deal goes through. But yes, very intriguing casting possibility there. And if everything works out, I really can't wait to see what Nick Cage does working with Issa Lopez. Next up, I wanted to mention that the new Peacock TV series, The Paper, which is the spinoff to kind of follow-up show to The Office, is actually going to be binge releasing its entire first season. I believe the original plan was to release four episodes on September 4th and then do, I think it was two episodes weekly after that. But now Peacock has decided to pivot to a binge release for this. So all 10 episodes of the first season are going to be available to stream on September 4th. Stay tuned to this podcast for more on that. Brad and I are going to be talking about that show in an upcoming episode, and hopefully, if all goes according to plan, we'll be presenting some interviews with some of the folks involved with that show. So yes, that is The Paper. Just kind of putting this on your radar if you're interested in all things The Office. Yeah, definitely check that out. So in just a few minutes, you're going to hear a Jacob's Trailer Park segment that we recorded a couple days ago. But I'm doing these things out of order right now, so sorry for the confusion on that front. But in any case, I wanted to mention this movie called Good Boy, which is a horror movie told from the perspective of a dog. So we're going to be talking about the actual trailer a little bit more in detail in just a minute. But the trailer received over a million views in 4 days. So IFC, the company behind the movie, decided to turn this from a limited release into a wide release, which is pretty cool. And I don't remember the last time I heard a company basically pivot to that degree and kind of prove to be as nimble and interested in capitalizing on potential success as what IFC is doing here. So I just thought it was notable and proof that there are still people out there who are willing to kind of take some chances and do interesting things in Hollywood. It seems like a lot of times everything just kind of falls into the same old category, and you can almost predict what these companies are going to do because they're so risk averse. But IFC saw the popularity of this trailer and said, hey, let's see if we can actually turn this into something that makes us a little bit more money and allows people to turn their excitement for this trailer into the opportunity to see the movie on the big screen. So that's pretty cool stuff there. Next up, Karen Gillan, from most people probably know her as playing Nebula from the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. She has joined Henry Cavill in the remake of Highlander that Chad Stahelski, the director of the John Wick movies, is making for Amazon MGM. I don't really have a ton to add here. I have not seen the original Highlander in 25 years or something, but Russell Crowe is in this movie. Marissa Abella from Industry is in this movie. Dave Bautista is in this movie. So it's got a pretty good cast. And I think Karen Gillan, when she shared the news on her social media accounts, said something along the lines of like, the voice coach can sit this one out or something, implying that she's going to be able to use her natural accent, which is pretty rare for her on screen. So I'm excited to hear what that sounds like in this context. K-Pop Demon Hunters. This is a movie that we haven't really talked about that much on this podcast, but it's officially become Netflix's most popular movie of all time. Very, very impressive stuff. I caught up with this movie not too long ago and really enjoyed it. So if you are on the fence about watching it or haven't jumped on that bandwagon yet, come on in. The water's fine. It's a really, really fun movie, and I was a big fan of it. So really impressive stuff for Netflix. Also impressive the fact that the sing-along version topped the box office this past weekend, which is, again, very, very impressive and shows that the fans of this movie are willing to come out and pay money to have that communal experience with and sing along to this movie with other people in the theater, which is something that we all probably need more of. And if you like the movie going experience, things like this might not be exactly up your alley, but I think all of us have to appreciate the idea of anything these days that can get people to turn out and show up in movie theaters and keep those theater doors open for us to see the stuff that we do care about. So there's that. I did want to call out something that Netflix is apparently doing. So there have been a couple reports here from Hollywood Reporter and The Wrap and Wall Street Journal over the past, let's call it, month or so about the future of this movie. And Netflix and Sony are talking about what they're going to do for potential sequels. But interestingly, Netflix is talking about doing a live action remake of K-Pop Demon Hunters. So jumping on the whole Disney bandwagon, the same thing Disney has been doing with all of its animated classics, same thing Universal and DreamWorks did with How to Train Your Dragon. So I expect this is probably going to be a trend that happens for every successful animated movie over the coming years, which I'm not thrilled about. And I actually don't even know how you go about turning K-Pop Demon Hunters into a live action movie. The style and the energy and the anime influences especially are so distinct to the world of animation that I just don't see how you can really translate that in live action. The closest thing I can think of that does something similar to what I imagine this might be like is Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which came out 15 years ago and was not a box office success. So I don't know if that strategy is going to be the best idea for Netflix. Although, frankly, it almost doesn't even matter about the quality of whatever live action movie they release because they're Netflix and they can just plop it under the service and people are going to be curious and they'll click on it and watch it. And then Netflix will be able to blast out a press release saying that it's one of the most watched things in the history of the service or whatever. And it doesn't even really matter about the quality of the final product there. So that's the cynical read on it. And I'm sorry to go in that direction, but because I like that first movie so much, I actually am invested in what happens now. And yes, they are working on an animated sequel. They're working on, I think, a stage show, several other ways to capitalize on this as a franchise. But the live action thing, man, I'm not a fan of that trend, as you probably know if you're listening to this podcast. So next up, I wanted to talk really quickly about a Knight Rider movie that is in the works at Universal. I swear, this is another one of those projects that's been in development for probably decades at this point. Knight Rider, for those of you who don't know, was a 1980s TV show where David Hasselhoff starred as a guy who had a talking car, and the guy who played Mr. Feeny on Boy Meets World provided the voice of the talking car, this computerized vehicle. So I don't know. There's something Hollywood is like obsessed with this as a concept, and I guess I get it to some degree. Maybe there's always the opportunity to comment on where we are with technology and our relationship to it, regardless of what year a Knight Rider project comes out. But the Cobra Kai guys are actually the ones who are working on the newest take on this. They're in talks to write the screenplay. Two out of the three of them are in early talks to direct the movie. David Leitch and Kelly McCormick, who worked on The Fall Guy and Atomic Blonde and several other major movies, Deadpool 2, Hobbs and Shaw, they're producing through their 87 North company, and they have a first look deal with Universal. So that's the studio that's probably going to be releasing this. I don't really have enough of a relationship to Cobra Kai to have much of an opinion on whether these guys are the right fit for this. I do know that at one point they were developing a spinoff movie set in the universe of Ferris Bueller's Day Off about the guys who take Cameron's dad's car for a joyride. I'm kind of glad that I haven't heard any updates about that project in a long time because I love Ferris Bueller and would rather that side project not exist. So if this Knight Rider reboot or whatever you want to call it, this movie adaptation takes up more of their time and energy and distracts them from the Ferris Bueller thing, then I guess I'm okay with it. So stay tuned for more on that. And then finally, I just wanted to provide a very quick update. I think we talked about this when it happened, but Todd Haynes, who is the director behind May December most recently, was working on a gay romance movie that had Joaquin Phoenix attached to star in it. And like the sets were built and they were days away from production. And Joaquin Phoenix left the production and that ended up resulting in the whole thing just completely falling apart. And there was a lot of consternation, I'll say, in the media entertainment space of people being like, what the hell, man? Like, what? There was never any reason offered. And it just, the whole thing seemed like a really terrible situation because a lot of people got fired or, I don't know if that's the proper term. A lot of people were banking on that work and ended up having to move on and figure out something else to do because they thought they were going to be working on a movie for however long, and that film ended up falling apart at the very last second. So now Pedro Pascal is in talks to star in that film, which is going to be called De Noche, and that's just an interesting replacement because those two guys starred in Eddington earlier this summer. And yeah, just a kind of a weird little coincidence or something there. But Todd Haynes is still on board. And I believe Danny Ramirez, who recently showed up in Captain America Brave New World, is going to be the other lead. It's this gay love story. And Pedro Pascal and Danny Ramirez are the main characters, and the story is set in, I think it's 1930s Mexico, and I don't really know if there are any more official details about the plot that have been released yet, but it's good to know that this project will hopefully, if this Pedro Pascal deal actually goes through, that this project will end up seeing the light of day after all. So that's all the news we have today. Let's jump right into our next segment here. Well, it's that time again. Joining me now is Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, it is time for another edition of Jacob's Trailer Park. So it's been a little while since we've done one of these, but there have been several interesting trailers that have come out over the past week or so. And let's just go ahead and jump right in and start running these down. So first up, the trailer for Osgood Perkins' Keeper, which is, I think, his third movie of the past, like, 14 months or something like that. It's wild how prolific he has become as a filmmaker. As usual, I'm going to link to all these trailers in the show notes. So if people want to watch and kind of follow along with us, they are free to do that. But what did you make of the trailer for Keeper?
It's a good trailer. It's leans very heavily on the A24 style of modern horror trailer cutting with the unusual soundtrack and the unnerving sound effects and the quick cuts to disturbing imagery. But this trailer mostly is interesting because it just feels like it's a earlier Osgood Perkins film. Like they're trying to sell it as if it's Black Coat's Daughter or I Am the Prey That Lives in the House, because Long Legs and The Monkey both had very accessible trailers cut to appeal to broad audiences. And this one really doesn't. It definitely seems to be going for the more art house crowd. So a 7.5 out of 10 for this trailer. Very curious about where this, if this direction will pay off for Neon, who, you know, scored two Osgood Perkins hits. But I'm not sure if this is a trailer that can make Monkey or Long Legs money, but I'm ready to be proven wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I think formally speaking, this trailer might be the most interesting one that we talk about here because it has that sort of split down the middle approach where it repeats a lot of the dialogue, but it basically does like a POV shift halfway through. And then kind of, it's almost like two trailers in one, like two character trailers, as opposed to like character posters. It's almost like two character centric trailers smashed into one thing. So I appreciated the swing in terms of like doing something different. So it definitely has my attention. Another movie that has my attention is called Good Boy. This is a movie that is from the POV of a dog, and it's a horror movie where something terrible happens to the dog's owner, I think. So what do you think about this trailer, Jacob?
Yeah, this trailer is good. I know it's good enough that IFC used the reaction to it to expand its theatrical release, which is really interesting and really neat. Yeah, it's leans very heavily on, hey, this is a horror movie starring a dog, and the dog's going to see all the horrible things that happen in a horror movie, and without necessarily the understanding that a human character would have, which is really interesting. And I missed this. This played at South by Southwest earlier this year, but I missed this year's festival due to an injury. So I can only go by what people have told me. I've been told by a few people this movie is excellent and very scary, and the dog actor, the lead dog, is extremely good, or is directed to be extremely good. This trailer is only okay for me. I wish it was a bit scarier or sold the premise a bit harder. It leans very heavily on those critic quotes to try to, you know, get the premise across. But I have it on good authority. This is a very good movie. We shall be excited for it. The doll looks very cute. 6 out of 10 for the trailer. But I'm told the movie is, you know, far better than that. So I'll definitely be seeing this one as soon as it's out.
Awesome. All right. So next up, we have a Netflix movie called Ballad of a Small Player. And this comes from Edward Berger, the director behind All Quiet on the Western Front and Conclave. And it stars Colin Farrell as a gambler in Macau, who's kind of down on his luck. So what do you think about this one?
Really good trailer, really stylishly cut. Lots of very colorful imagery, lots of shots of Colin Farrell looking at his worst. And I mean that in a good way. Few handsome men are so dedicated to making themselves look like garbage as Colin Farrell has in the past few years. And I'm all here for it. I love me some messed up, ruffled, sweaty Colin Farrell. And Edward Berger's proven to be like the real deal now. I think All Quiet on the Western Front was very much a, oh, who is this guy type of debut. And Conclave sealed the deal for me. So I'll see whatever this guy does from here on out. I'm sold. I'm on the Edward Berger train. And I've been on the Colin Farrell train for a long time. And even though this trailer tells you nothing but plot, it's entirely tone. The tone feels sweaty and gaudy and mesmerizing and unsettling. So yeah, this is a real, I'm going to give this trailer an 8.5 out of 10. Just because this is the kind of trailer that makes me want to see this on the big screen, which is a bummer because this is a Netflix movie.
Yeah. Okay. So I have not seen the first season of Fallout, but I'm pretty sure you did, right?
Yeah. I'm a big fan. I love Fallout.
Okay. So the trailer for Fallout season 2 is now out, and I watched this trailer all the way through just because I heard so many great things about the first season and was just kind of curious of like what this thing is. Obviously, most of this didn't make sense to me because I have no connection to the games or these characters. But as somebody who is familiar with the video game world and also liked that first season, what do you think about this season 2 trailer?
Yeah, this trailer is cut entirely for people who are excited for season 2 after seeing season 1. It's unforgiving, Ben. Everything in this is baffling if you haven't seen the first season. So, but yeah, in terms of delivering on the set, the cliffhanger ending of season 1, like real good stuff here. It's teasing what was set up. It's showing off what the characters are up to as Walton Goggins in full nasty anti-hero mode. Once again, he's the reason to watch the show, even though the whole show is good. Giving this one an 8 out of 10. It's a very traditional trailer. No real surprises here in terms of how it's cut. But if its job is to remind me that season 2 is out later this year and to be excited for it, well, it certainly did its job. I am curious though, Ben, after seeing this footage and not being able to follow it narratively, was there anything visual here or a moment that made you want to go watch season 1?
Yeah, I think actually just the whole thing, it just looks so good. You know, that's the most basic way that I can put it. A lot of streaming TV these days just looks like absolute dog shit, and this does not. This looks like a very expensive show, and it looks like every dollar actually comes across on screen. So that's, again, a pretty basic way to look at it. But as somebody who doesn't have that emotional connection to it, I just kind of sat back in awe at this thing and was like, wow, this looks very nice. Nice may be a weird word for a post-apocalyptic show set in the desert, but very expensive, very high quality anyway. So I may have to go back and check out that first season in the lead up to this. So
I really recommend this. Watch the first episode of season 1. And if you're sold then on that episode is offering, then you'll dig it. And if you don't like episode 1, then you'll know the show is not for you. It's that kind of, it's not like a show where it's like, oh, to watch the first 4 episodes, see if you like it. It's the first episode, you like it or you don't type thing.
Okay. Do you remember off the top of your head how many episodes are in season 1?
8, I believe.
Okay. And then is it like an hour long thing or is it?
Yeah, it's like, you know, the whole like between 45 minutes and 65 minutes, depending on the episode kind of thing.
Okay. All right. Not too much of a commitment there. Okay. All right. So a few more trailers to get to here. How about the trailer for Kelly Reichardt's The Mastermind, which is starring Josh O'Connor, and it's kind of a heist movie. I actually watched only the first few seconds of this trailer and was like, oh, I'm intrigued by this. I actually don't even need to finish this. But since we've locked you into this segment, Jacob, it is your job to watch these trailers to the end. So what do you think about this one?
Oh, man, this is where I have to maybe hand in one of my film critic cards, because I run very hot and cold in Kelly Reichardt. I sometimes like her and sometimes find her unbearable. I don't know which mode she's in here. This definitely feels like a more accessible premise than a lot of other films. Like you said, it's a heist story, albeit one that's, you know, very, very low stakes from the look of it. And I love Josh O'Connor, and he seems to be doing like really unique, different work for him, playing a real loser. Which is unusual. Well, like, he's played losers before, but a different kind of losers than he's played in the past. But like I said, the name Kelly Reichardt sometimes scares me, because I just don't know, because everybody loves her, and I have admired some of her films, but I struggle with her pacing. I know it's part of the point. And this trailer just made me go, oh, it's another one of those from Kelly Reichardt. So I want to give the trailer a 6 out of 10, just because watching it just kind of gave me flashbacks to my lesser Kelly Reichardt experiences.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm probably in the same boat. I need to see more of her movies. I think I've only seen like 3 or 4 of her films, so I need to do some catch up there. All right, so this next one is fascinating because I had no idea this movie existed. It's called Arco, and Neon is releasing it. It's an animated movie that I think is coming out later this year, and it has a really spectacular voice cast. I think Will Ferrell and Natalie Portman and like a bunch of other people are in it, and it seems kind of like an international feature that's maybe being redubbed for an American release or something. I didn't do a ton of research into this, but I was kind of taken by this trailer. But what did you think about it?
Yeah, the imagery is beautiful. This trailer is showing off really staggering 2D animation. I mean, the closest comparison will be Studio Ghibli, because the only people, you know, consistently doing the similar work these days, but it's not aping that style. It's its own thing, but definitely has a sort of anime influence to it, but it looks very heavy on science fiction. Lots of robots, very colorful, almost no story in this trailer. It's purely trying to sell you on the beauty and the animation, which is probably the right choice here. But the trailer is kind of funny to me, because it has all this majestic imagery and sci-fi, you know, settings, and this weird, you know, beautiful 2D animation. Then, as you said, the most random voice cast, where it's like Will Ferrell, Natalie Portman, and Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers. So I was like, okay, that voice cast does not match the imagery of this trailer, which I'm going to give a 7.5 out of 10, because yes, you have my attention, Neon, now reel me in.
Okay. All right. The last one we're going to get to here is called Anemone. And I was talking with Chris Evangelista about this. And when this movie was announced, he and I both kind of wrote it off a little bit, because it comes from the son of Daniel Day-Lewis. I think his name is Ronan Day-Lewis. And both of us were just like, oh, this is just going to be kind of like a vanity project that lures Daniel Day-Lewis out of retirement. I don't think he's made a movie since Phantom Thread in, what was that, 2017, 2018, something like that. And this is probably just going to be, you know, a Nepo baby project. And the trailer was surprisingly strong, I thought. But what did you think about it?
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis once again rocking his Gangs of New York mustache. Or something close to it. But yeah, I love that he's back. He's, you know, it's hard. It's an actor as good as he is. There's no way to overrate him. Like, him being back in any capacity is thrilling. And yeah, I was also prepared to write this off as a, you know, oh, he's giving his son a boost. But there's a real horror vibe this trailer. I'm not sure if it's a horror movie or it's a thriller with horror elements, but it's very creepy. And watching Danny Lewis and Sean Bean sort of face off in this trailer really has my attention. It definitely there's imagery in this trailer that I'm not prepared to unpack yet, not knowing the plot. It definitely seems to be dealing a lot with recent, and by recent I mean past 50 years, Irish history, which, you know, Danny Lewis himself is Irish, and interestingly, it looks like Ronan Day-Lewis and Daniel Day-Lewis both co-wrote the script, so clearly they're perhaps exercising some very personal demons here about themselves and maybe their home nation, that I don't know what to expect. This trailer gives me just enough to know that, oh, maybe Ronan Day-Lewis is not some Nepo baby. Maybe he does have an Ari Aster-esque, you know, horror thriller in him, which is what this trailer is absolutely selling. So yeah, I'm going to give this one 8 out of 10.
All right, I know we're not really big on Oscar prognostication on this show, but just because it is the return of arguably the most celebrated actor of the 20th century or maybe 21st century, the past 50 years in Hollywood even, who the hell knows? He's up there with the Pacinos and the De Niros and all that, right? So do you think this is like an automatic lock for a best actor? Certainly a nomination, but do you think, based on only this trailer, do you think he's going to win the trophy for best actor at the Oscars?
No. I mean, he has three of them already, and it already counts against him. And also, I think this having any kind of horror vibe at all in it will be the kind of thing that turns off Oscar voters. I know every time an Oscar movie, like, every time an Oscar is gravitated toward a horror movie in any respect, it's a massive story. And so I think that a movie with this tone becoming an Oscar player would delight me to no end, but I wouldn't put any currency on it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. That's going to bring us to the end of this segment. Jacob, where can people find you online?
I'm working at slashfilm.com, and you can find me doing another podcast with former Slash Filmer and occasional guest Hoi Chan Bui, Trekking Time and Space, where we talk about Star Trek and Doctor Who. You can find that wherever you listen to podcasts.
Awesome. Thanks, Jacob.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
With me now to talk about Honey Don't is Slash Film staff writer Bill Bria.
Hey there.
Hey, Bill, how's it going? Okay, so let's jump right in and talk a little bit about this movie. This is the, I guess, technically second film from Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook, the married couple who, they're married, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's something you have to do a double take on.
Yeah, just making sure. The married couple who, they wrote and produced and directed Driveway Dolls last year, and now they are back with a mystery story starring Margaret Qualley. And I was curious, I think you and I are some of the only people in the country to see this movie, Bill, because it did not perform very well at all at the box office. But what did you think about this one?
I enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed it a little bit more than Driveway Dolls, just for my own proclivities. I enjoyed both movies, but I think that where Driveway Dolls is sort of reminiscing or harking back to, you know, something sort of more classic Coen's, even though both movies are very much Ethan and Trisha's and not, you know, Ethan and Joel's. I felt like Honey Don't was more of a move away from the sort of traditional Coen brothers, and that's in quotes, you know, noir pastiche, but it still felt honest in the way that I know that obviously Ethan Coen has, you know, with his brother, you know, throughout their career, been interested in film noir and the noir tropes and characters and ideas. And this felt, you know, in the same way that Driveway Dolls was kind of hearkening to a 1950s or 60s, not a beach party movie, but, you know, that sort of vibe of like, you know, gals on the run sort of, you know, if they took that and brought it up to like a 90s sensibility, this felt like a 90s sensibility version of a pulp novel to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. That was my biggest takeaway, was that like basically you could plop Humphrey Bogart into the lead role here and it would be indistinguishable from, you know, 20 movies that were made across the 40s and 50s, you know? So Margaret Qualley, I thought, was just doing a really fantastic kind of Bogart impression. She's very dry in this movie. Her sense of humor is very dry, her characters. And that, I think, doesn't necessarily come across super well in the trailers, but I thought it worked much better in context. There's a line in particular where she's having a conversation with Chris Evans' character, who's playing this kind of a shady priest who is basically using the church as a way to lure in women so he can have sex with them. There's no other way to say it.
No, there's not.
So there's an interrogation scene between the two of them, and Chris Evans' character looks at Margaret Qualley and says, "You're fascinating." And she says, "You haven't even seen the riddle that's tattooed on my ass." Mm-hmm. And there's no, like, the movie doesn't like pause and think that that's a laugh line necessarily, but she just delivers it super straight faced and then just moves immediately on to the next thing. And in the trailer, I was kind of like, oh, that's not super funny. It doesn't really, I don't know, I'm not really sure how I feel about that. Right. But in the context of the movie itself, it just plays like a Bogart line. It plays like something that would have been a line in The Big Sleep or something, where he's just constantly throwing off these, like, or even Casablanca, he does this a lot too. These really quick, witty little one-liner responses to things. And I just think if people go into this movie with the mindset of, imagine this is effectively an old school film noir, they're going to have a lot more fun with it than trying to parse it through any other lens, you know?
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I love that you said all that. And I think, you know, even just using that line as an example, it's funny to me, but it's funny in a way that's not, obviously it's not Marvel Cinematic Universe funny, or, you know, Judd Apatow funny. It's also not Shane Black funny. And Shane Black has really, you know, cemented his voice throughout his career with this sort of neo-noir, you know, pastiche that he likes to do. And mm-hmm. what's great about this movie is that it doesn't really feel like it belongs in that same world, even though obviously it's the same genre. But I don't see, you know, Cook and Cohen, you know, attempting to sort of compete with Black in that way, and they don't even really feel it. It doesn't even feel like they're competing with themselves, or at least the Cohen brothers, in the sense that, like, I think people might be going into this expecting a Big Lebowski-esque, you know, romp, where that movie, of course, with its, you know, sort of Raymond Chandler homage, felt still very intentionally funny in a way that's accessibly funny to most audiences. This one, you know, it's not even necessarily ha-ha laugh all the time, but right. there is a lot of humor that I can find in, you know, even just Charlie Day's performance. And of course, Charlie Day's known for being very funny, but there's this archness while still really conforming to the tenets of the genre, as you were saying, like a Bogart example. And it's a gossamer thin sort of, you know, line of humor that's in this movie that is very distinct and also is very personal. So it may be your cup of tea, it may not be, but I think it is really funny.
Yeah, and shout out to Charlie Day. Yeah, I fully back that, because he just really made me laugh out loud. He was one of the few characters that actually made me laugh out loud in this movie, and I thought he was really wonderful in it. And he has a pretty small role, but every time he pops on screen, I was really smiling and enjoying myself throughout. So
Yeah,
is there anything else we should talk about with this movie? I mean, I feel like we're doing our best to kind of make the case and maybe convince people to see it. I don't really want to get into spoilers and right. ruin any of the mystery or anything for people sure. who haven't checked it out yet. But is there any other addition you can say to kind of add to our case here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the fact that it is very offbeat is something to lean on in terms of getting people to sort of prime their minds of what they're going to get into. You know, this is something that I mentioned this in my review for the site, that, you know, Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook were planning before this and Drive Away Dolls, a quote unquote lesbian B movie trilogy. So this would be the second part of that after Drive Away Dolls. And, you know, it that's another sort of thing to have in the back of your mind, that it does feel in a way, it feels, like I was saying earlier, like a combination of the sensibility of 90s indie film, you know, very idiosyncratic, very deadpan, very, mm-hmm. you know, willing to sort of linger in little, you know, moments and scenes that, you know, other studio films would be like, get out of there quickly, you know, combined with a sort of, you know, 1950s pulp aesthetic of, and not just not the visuals necessarily, but just the vibe, right?
Yeah.
Of, you know, this movie opens with like a beautiful woman, you know, not investigating, but being near the scene of a crime, and then immediately gets completely naked and does a skinny dip and then drives away on her motorcycle. And, you know, it's very like, you know, as if Russ Meyer were making, you know, Kiss Me Deadly or something, you know. but I did want to say, too, that I really, and I wanted to bring this up to see if you felt the same way. I really appreciated in this movie, you know, most film noirs, especially urban film noirs, you know, if they take place in Chicago or New York City or LA or whatever, they really lean on this idea of, oh, the grimy city, the sad city. We've got to, you know, this movie literally starts with the song, "We Got to Get Out of This Place." And what I really appreciated about what Ethan was able to bring to this movie is this sense of real desperation of this small town. I think it's set in Bakersfield, California. I'm not sure if it was filmed there too or not, but it, wherever they shot it, it looks as desolate as you'd expect, and not even desolate in a very like stylized or aggressive way. It just feels boring, you know?
Yeah, totally. I think that's a great call. And I think that's what helps distinguish this visually from, you know, a character walking in between skyscrapers and stuff like that. You've got more like strip malls and things like that, that the character has to search through in. It's more like that kind of a milieu instead of, a lot of like reflective glass and things. Like, you don't really get a lot of the same visual tropes that you often see in film noir with like the light pouring through window slats and things like that, right? Like that's not exactly what's going on here. It's much brighter than that, which contrasts with the violence and the kind of darkness of the mystery at the core of this thing. So I think it works really well. I mean, I'm a big fan of this movie, and the overriding thought that I had walking out of it was, I wish we got like six movies like this a year. You know, it just seems like it's so small and contained, and like simple is maybe going to sound like I'm insulting it or something. And the plot is actually like somewhat labyrinthine. It's not like the easiest thing to track, but it's not super difficult. But there's stuff going on in it. But it just, in terms of like a mounting a film production of this size, you know, it feels like a mid-budget movie. It feels like the kind of thing that we are always lamenting doesn't really exist. And I'm just happy to see something like this happen. And I wish there could be six or seven of these every year. And if Margaret Qualley happens to star in all of them, then sure, that's great. That's fine. But, I actually thought she was much better in this than in Driveway Dolls. She's doing like a Raising Arizona out there voice in Driveway Dolls. And I think that can be a little much for people. But here she's much more like dialed down, and Aubrey Plaza shows up and she's doing her Aubrey Plaza thing. So you kind of know what you're going to get in terms of that dryness that kind of goes across multiple characters as well. So I just think there are a lot of like really cool elements that came together in a fun way for this movie. I wish more people would check it out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's something that, as you were saying, really sort of scratches that itch of feeling like a movie that, you know, has movie stars in it. It's made by, you know, legacy filmmakers, and yet it doesn't necessarily have to feel like a huge event or, you know, a multi-million dollar, you know, big budget blockbustery thing. You know, this is a movie that really feels through and through to me. Handmade is not the right term. I'm thinking, I don't know, heartfelt, in the sense that, like, you know, this feels like the movie, exactly the type of movie that Cook and Cohen wanted to make, as well as all the way to the fact that, like, this movie has a few songs by Margaret Qualley in them, produced by her husband, Jack Antonoff. And, you know, in another movie, it would feel like a real, you know, sort of ego trip, right? But it has the sense to it of sort of a ragtag sort of group of, I don't know, a theater troupe or something, where it's like, we're just doing this because we love making this kind of art. And, you know, we hope you like it too, sort of thing.
Yeah, it absolutely has that feeling to it. Okay, cool. Well, any closing thoughts, anything we didn't get a chance to say yet about Honey Don't? This is probably, unfortunately, the last time we'll talk about it for a while.
Yeah, no, I think it's something that, as you were saying, you know, not enough people are seeing. It's sort of getting lost in the shuffle. And if there is any buzz about it, it's, you know, the buzz of disappointment from people that were expecting a more traditional Coen Brothers film, or, I don't know, maybe something closer to an action film, because they think of noir as being more of an action genre, when really it's not. You know, it's more about the investigation. It's more about the foibles and the corruption of the characters, that sort of thing. It can go into action, but it doesn't have to, you know? And so it's a hard movie to appeal to a general audience, in the sense that it's not thrills and chills all the way through. But I think if you are someone who is already inclined to be interested in the idiosyncratic and the offbeat, you really do owe it to yourself to check this out, just to, you know, see what idiosyncrasies are in it, you know?
Yeah. Cool. All right. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
Joining me to present an interview, we have Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad. So tell me who you had a chance to talk to.
I had the chance to talk to Geraldine Viswanathan, who is one of the supporting stars of Thunderbolts. She plays Mel, who is Valentina's assistant in the movie. And she plays a key role in the movie, even though she's not a superhero or a supervillain. I've been a fan of her for a while because she's quite hilarious in movies like Blockers and whatnot. So it was a real treat to get to talk to her about working on Thunderbolts. And we also dig a little bit into comedy at the very end of our interview because I just know that she's a big comedy nerd. And it was a fun thing to pick her brain a little bit about the kind of comedies that she likes and whatnot. So, yeah, it's just a fun little interview.
Excellent. Yeah, at one point during this conversation, she mentions Io, and I forgot that Io Debris was at one point supposed to be in Thunderbolts, and I guess it must have been for the role that she ended up playing. So, yeah, I just like totally that information left my brain. So as soon as she said that, I was like, oh, all these pieces are clicking into place now. So if anybody's wondering what she's talking about there, I think that's the proper context. So, yeah, Thunderbolts is now streaming on Disney Plus, which is the reason that Geraldine was doing these interviews. And any closing thoughts, Brad? What do you think about Thunderbolts now? I know we had a whole big conversation about it when that movie initially came out, but considering that it didn't really perform up to the standards that I think Marvel was hoping, has the reputation of the movie changed at all in your mind since we talked about it?
I don't know about the reputation. You know, for me, I really like the movie a lot. I think it's the best Marvel movie this year. Is it the only Marvel movie this year?
Fantastic Four.
There we go. Yeah, I think it's better than Fantastic Four. Just to show you the fact that I forgot that it came out this year probably indicates that.
And Captain America. I forgot about that one.
Oh, there we go. Yep. Okay. Yeah, this Thunderbolts is definitely the best Marvel movie of the year. Not quite the best superhero movie of the year because I do like Superman more, but I like Thunderbolts a lot. I think it does some really interesting things and goes against the grain of what we usually expect from Marvel movies. And I think that the cast does a fantastic job of stepping up into their roles, and that the script really does a good job of utilizing characters that you otherwise probably didn't care about very much, and it makes you care about most of them in a way that is very surprising.
All right, well, here is Brad's conversation with Geraldine.
Geraldine, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad. It's great to talk to you. Bye. So I'm curious, you were about 13 when the Marvel Cinematic Universe was just taking shape, when Iron Man came out in 2008. And in your acting career, you've mostly done comedies with a bit of drama here and there. So I was wondering if before Thunderbolts came along, did you have any desire to jump into like a big blockbuster movie like this? Or were you satisfied sticking, you know, in that comedic drama realm?
I have a line in the film that's like, I was in high school when the Avengers came, and I really, right. I really was. Like, I remember seeing Avengers in, you know, the mall in my hometown, and just how thrilling that was. And then I remember seeing Black Panther when I moved to Brooklyn, and like, it just kind of is this like, I don't know. Yeah. We've all kind of grown with Marvel, and can be these kind of signifiers of like times in your life. So, and then, yeah, I mean, it's such a dream, I think, for an actor to join the universe. And my mom actually, when I first came to LA, saw a psychic, and she was like, I see your daughter in like a superhero, on like a superhero billboard. And so it was definitely kind of in, it was definitely a dream of mine. Yeah, so when this came together in such a kind of, you know, it really came out of the blue. I just, I'm friends with Io, and then like Jake wanted to talk to me, and it just, the way it all came together felt very kind of like organic and,
Yeah. So obviously you were in Blockers before, and Catherine Newton is also in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You guys have any talk? Did you talk to her about, you know, gearing up and getting into that Marvel Studios mindset?
Yeah, we did. I asked her about it. I was like, anything I need to know? And she was like, it's just so fun. You'll just have so much fun. So That was nice. And yeah, I think that was the extent of our conversation about it. And yeah, because you never know. So I was like,
Yeah.
I was happy to have that kind of vote of confidence.
Also, it's
Appreciate it.
pretty cool that you basically get to spend most of your time with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is just this huge comedic icon. I'm sure that was huge for you.
Yeah, it was insane. I think that was really, just a pinch me moments throughout the whole shoot, just getting to like spar with her and then like just hang out on set and do this whole process with her. I think she is just my idol and is just, yeah, exactly like who I want to be. She's a legend and was very, so that kind of dynamic between us came very easily for me because I just wanted to impress her and be as close to her as possible.
Do you have a good Julia story that you can share from being on set with her?
Well, she's very thoughtful and she discovered that my favorite flavor, one of my favorite flavors is the dill pickle. So she sent me a huge box of dill pickle chips
Oh, nice.
when she heard that I hadn't tried them before, she was like, send me your address right now. And I'm still chipping away. I still have some bags to go. So, she keeps me snacked up and that, and I appreciate that.
There, I do like a snack food thing that I do on Instagram on the side, and there are tons of pickle flavored things out right now.
Right, yeah. Pickles are
Yeah.
having a moment.
That's so big. So, what was it like being on set for the moment when the new Avengers were announced? And how hard was that for you to keep secret?
It was hard for me to keep it a secret. I was just so excited by it, but also nobody trusts me with their secrets, so I was quite happy to kind of have one and prove that I could do it. It was so exciting. That day on set was so special and I'll never forget it. We're on the New York street set and one of the few scenes that I get to be with the whole cast and they had to send the extras away to do the they kind of shot like a dummy version of that speech
Right.
Julia gives and then they did the real deal without any extras and that just felt really exciting and yeah, kind of like we had this top secret thing that we were gonna like eventually, launch into the world.
Yeah.
So it was really cool.
Now, Mel isn't necessarily running into the action in Thunderbolts, but I wonder, did you still have to go through any Marvel training or like get like a digital double scan of yourself just in case for any of that stuff?
Yeah, I opted into the Marvel training, absolutely, because that is hello. When am I, that's I wanted to experience that. And yeah, we did do the digital scanning stuff, which was so bizarre.
Did you get to see your digital double?
I don't know if I did.
I
It's
bet
so
that's so
weird to
surreal.
know that there just is a digital double of me, like
Yeah.
in some drive somewhere. Ugh. But also, yeah, also cool.
Yeah.
And but yeah, very kind of futuristic and bizarre.
Do you get any insight as to whether or not there's a chance like you'll get your own Mel action figure, maybe a two-pack with Valentina?
Oh, I'm actually gonna tap in about that. I'm gonna
You
ask her.
should.
There's gotta be. With a little like ponytail on the phone, like
Exactly, and give her the Sentry kill switch.
give her the button.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now I want that.
That's got to be cool too, because you are technically the only character who has defeated Sentry.
That's right.
That
That's right. Pretty.
deserves an action figure, I
Yeah.
think. Now, is there a Marvel character that you'd really like Mel to share the screen with, or is there an actor from elsewhere in the MCU that you're dying to share a scene with?
Let's see. I mean, I love Mark Ruffalo. I'm a big Mark Ruffalo fan. I would
Yeah, of
love
course.
to share a scene with him. But then also I just saw Fantastic Four, and I mean all of them. I mean all of them. But maybe Eben. Shout out Eben. I
There
kind
you go.
of have a thing for like huge rock guys.
Yeah. Maybe he'll still have the beard by then too. Who knows if he'll get rid of it.
Yeah,
The
that'd be nice.
big rock beard. All
Yeah.
right, so I wanted to shift gears a bit and talk about comedy with you because I know that that's your jam. Do you have any bucket list filmmakers or comedy actors that like you're dying to work with?
Absolutely. Bucket list comedy director would have to be, I mean, Edgar Wright. I
Yes.
love his movies so much, and
Same.
I would die to work with Edgar Wright, but then also I just saw Naked Gun and Akiva. I would love to work
Oh
with him.
man, yeah.
He's made, I mean, between like Naked Gun and Popstar and all the Lonely Island stuff, I just think he's made like the
Yeah.
most incredible comedies of this time, and yeah, so
Those are good picks.
those are two bucket list ones.
You
Yeah.
got to work with Kyle Mooney for Saturday Morning All-Star Hits, right? That was pretty cool, I imagine.
That was very cool. I'm such a Kyle Mooney fan, and yeah, he's the best. We met on Miracle Workers, and he's a pal now. But yeah, no, I totally geeked out when I first met him because
Yeah.
have been such a fan for so long. Yeah, maybe we should get him in the MCU.
I would love to see that
Oh
happen.
man,
Are there can you name four comedies that you never get sick of? Like your go-to whenever like you're feeling like you need to laugh, a feel-good movie that just always brings out, the hilarity.
I think Bridesmaids
Yeah.
has to be on that list. She's the Man. I love that
Nice.
movie. And that is like when I'm sick, like I'll watch She's the Man. And I love Popstar.
Ah, yes.
Stopping. And then what's like a random one? I love MacGruber too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Yeah.
All good picks. I love that.
Thank you.
Now, okay, so given the opportunity to host Saturday Night Live, big gig, is there any impression, something you have in your back pocket that you know, oh yeah, I would love to do that on SNL.
Oh, that's a great question. It's like I'm thinking. I've been working on a Nicki Minaj impression. I don't know if that's gonna make it on
Oh man.
SNL, but
Can
just for
you
my life, just for fun. And no,
give
I'm
like
not gonna do
a
it.
little taste?
I'm
No.
not gonna do it.
Oh
No way, Bradford.
man. I
I'm
was
saving
hoping.
it.
Okay, fair enough.
Saving it for Saturday night.
I'll just hope one day that we get to see it on the show. All right. Well, that is my time. Thank you so much, Geraldine. It's great talking to you. I love so much of the stuff you do, and I can't wait to see what else you got coming up after this. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
All right, we're going to wrap things up with just a quick listener email. Yi Feng from Boston wrote in offering some more information about the conversation Bill and I had about physical media last week. And there are three points that Yi Feng wants to make. Number one, the biggest jump in quality on disc versus streaming is audio. Currently, all streaming platforms are lossy. An average two-hour film is around 500 megabytes lossy for streaming, which is equivalent to crappy MP3s, versus 5 gigabytes lossless, basically identical to studio masters with no loss at all. So if Wes, the person who wrote in to us last week, has full-range speakers, you can tell movie soundtracks on Blu-rays have 10 times more information than any streaming platform. So there's another notch in the physical media category, just the audio level there. As for video quality, number two, Yifeng says, bitrate-wise, the most famous example is the Game of Thrones episode The Long Night, which was a pixelated dark mess on HBO Max. But on 4K disc, using a properly calibrated Dolby Vision display, you won't see pixelization nor macro blocking, but pristine, high-quality HDR image. The biggest selling feature of 4K is HDR, and HDR stands for High Dynamic Range, which is all about the contrast in the images. So the blacks actually look black. It's much more realistic and detailed when you get into talking about HDR stuff. And then the third and final point here involves what Wes wrote in last week about asking if there was any chance that we'd see 120 frames per second disc version of Ang Lee's Gemini Man. And Yifeng says, at the time of this email, Gemini Man and Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk are the only two titles on 4K disc encoded with 60 frames per second Dolby Vision. Every other 4K disc is 24 frames per second. Currently, 4K discs do not allow for higher than 60 frames per second, but can potentially be updated to be variable or 120 frames per second. But as of today, it tops out at 60. So yes, there's a little bit more context for that. And who knows if maybe one day we'll see discs with 120 frames per second projects encoded onto them. That would be pretty wild, especially if that becomes like a big thing. I expect if that happens, it's going to be in kind of one-off cases like this, but you never know. So stay tuned for all of that and much more on future episodes of the show. You can find more about some of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes as well. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That truly, truly, truly helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show if you haven't done that yet. We'd really appreciate that. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.